The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticise. You are listening to ACH, I'm Andy, your host. And on today's instalment, I'm talking to you, originally recorded and broadcast on Monday, April the 28th, 2025, at achshow.com. I will be presenting a show entitled The Rarest Record in the World. And the time is 10:30 a.m. here in London, making it, 5:30 over on the East Coast of America and 2:30 on the West Coast of America. Welcome to wherever you are around the world. Okay, so the original rarest record in the world is Music for Supermarkets by Jean-Michel Jarre. I met him once, actually, as I had a friend who was a big fan of his, so upon hearing he was going to be on ITV's Good Morning Britain, we took a night bus up to London in the late 1980s and were hanging around the studio entrance in Camden Town at around 4 in the morning. Upon his arrival, he signed the only two CDs of his I had and was quite surprised when I asked him to sign the disc itself rather than the inlay cover. He actually wrote Bon Idée, which I believe means good idea in French, on the disc, and was an extremely approachable and pleasant gentleman. But back to Music for Supermarkets, here is its brief description from Wikipedia. Music for Supermarkets is the sixth studio album by electronic musician and composer Jean-Michel Jarre. Only a single vinyl copy was ever pressed. It was sold at an auction where its master plates were deliberately destroyed. However, later Jarre albums such as Zuluk 1984 or Rendezvous 1986 sample stroke reused several parts of the album. In 1983, Jarre was approached to create background music for a supermarket-themed art show, Orimbe, to be held in Paris during June 1983. Jarre recorded the album between February and May. Comparing the album to a painting, not just a worthless commercial product, he chose to auction it along with other art pieces. The auction was held on July the 6th, 1983, at the Hotel Drouot auction house in Paris, and raised about 69,000 francs, equivalent to $8,960 at the time, for charity. Jarre explained this was his protest at the silly industrialisation of music. In the inside cover, 11 Polaroid photos show the step-by-step creation of the disc, leaving one slot so that the final owner could add their photo with the album. The album owner was kept anonymous at first, but later revealed to be real estate dealer M. Girard. Shortly after the auction, Jarre allowed Radio Luxembourg to broadcast the album once in its entirety and encouraged listeners to record the broadcast with the words "Piratez-moi," which means "pirate me." Various parts of this album would be reworked for later Jarre projects such as Zuluk 1984 or Rendezvous 1986, as I just mentioned, and a demo version of Music for Supermarkets Part 1 was included on the 2018 compilation Planet Jarre 50 Years of Music. So it's an album, obviously. I see it's got 8 tracks, 5 on the A side, 3 on the B side, or side 1 and side 2. And then we move on to, so as I say, this goes back to 1983. But there is a little link here to an album called Once Upon a Time in Shaolin, an album by American hip-hop artist Wu-Tang Clan. So let's go over there. Once Upon a Time in Shaolin is the seventh studio album by the American hip-hop group Wu-Tang Clan. Only one copy was created with no ability to download or stream it. Feeling the value of music had been cheapened by the internet, the producers, Silver Rings and RZA, hoped to return it to the value of fine art. The only copy was purchased directly from the group in 2015 for $2 million, making it the most expensive work of music ever sold. Okay. Excuse me. The album was recorded in secret over 6 years, from 2007 to 2013. And I'll just summarise here without running all through it. The guy who got the item was someone called Martin Shkreli or something. He's the CEO of Turing Pharmaceuticals. He won the item with a $2 million bid. But he was subsequently convicted for securities fraud, and all his assets were seized by the United States government. And one of those was this album. So it ended up going up for auction again, and it was told to the Non-Fungible Token Collectors Pleaser DAO for $4 million. And that is that. So that is, it was the most expensive at $2 million ever, and now it's the, obviously, twice that. So there you go. I would have expected the most expensive or the rarest record ever to be by the likes of the Beatles or Elvis Presley, but it was actually by Wu-Tang Clan, which goes to show it is not down to the popularity of the artist, but the rarity of the item. So what can you take away from this? Well, obviously, you could type in details of some of your records into eBay and see what comes up. But a more specialist website is discogs.com. That's discogs.com, discogs.com, where you can type in details of a record, CD or cassette, maybe even an 8-track that you have, and find a list of sellers offering the item, which will give you a good idea of its value. But be warned, it will give you every version of your record that was released throughout the world, which is available or has been available in the past on discogs.com. So whilst it can be a somewhat onerous exercise for some, for those who are interested in records, it can be a most rewarding one. For example, I have 9 different 7-inch singles of Dire Straits' Sultans of Swing, released in 1978. This is because different countries release them in different picture sleeves. I have a couple of promotional copies, and even once, there was one that was produced specially for use in an American jukebox. This is one of the least rare, funnily enough, and only cost me a few pounds. The rarest is the Japanese issue of the single, but don't forget, you don't have to buy. It can be an enjoyable experience just to trawl through the different versions of some of your favourite records on the website, where you will see the different picture sleeves and the details of each of them. Okay. So this bonus show was made possible via a £50 donation from a kind supporter of the show, which means they not only provided the £15 I needed for a bonus show, but they have also put £35 in the kitty, which means I only need another £15 for another bonus show. So if you want to be part of that, the donate button is at the top of my website, achshow.com, and the rest is up to you. Okay, so whilst today's topic element of the show was rare records, what I always try to do with a topic is give you the opportunity to participate in the topic, hence my mention of the Discogs website, in the hope that you have some fun with it. So it's not all about me. The idea is the show's all about you. Maybe this will give you Maybe you're one of these people, like myself sometimes, that goes on eBay or Amazon out of frustration, boredom, looking for something to buy and that you don't really need and because you're bored. You know, you might be listening to some show or what have you and you're on the internet. It's good to do things like window shopping, looking at different things. You don't have to buy them. Believe me, folks, I said this before. If I could turn back the clock, I wouldn't have bought these rare records. I had a friend of mine years ago who got me into this. There was a rare second-hand record shop near where we lived. I was just always interested in the music. Now, the sort of rare records that would interest me, I remember one of the first ones I bought, which was a live concert by Dire Straits from 1979 in America. And it was a promo live album. So it wasn't a bootleg, it wasn't a pirate copy. It was a program called the Warner Brothers Music Show, and they would go to a particular concert, they would record it all professionally, and then they would press it onto records and send it out to various radio stations. And what they were supposed to do was, after they broadcast it, destroy it. But of course, loads of people ended up keeping them. They go out into the market. And I paid, in the late 1980s, £30 for that, which is quite a bit of money back then. And I think it goes for over 100 today. But you see, that is a professionally recorded live concert that you couldn't go to the shops and buy. So that's the sort of thing that would interest me. Or maybe, you know, rare songs, stuff like that. But in the past, you know, they were, again, bootlegs. So the sound quality suffered as a result. But those 9 copies of Sultans of Swing I just mentioned, I probably only looked at them when I got them out to check that they were okay and I filed them away. So it's not a hobby that I recommend, but it's certainly just as much fun to look at things like that online. And the one thing that I did get into through it, which was interesting for me, was I ended up working for a rare record dealer at the time, because what I ended up doing was moving on from collecting, because I really collected Dire Straits. That was what I liked. And, you know, occasionally you might stumble upon something else. And but that was my main thing. If you spread yourself too thinly, it's better to focus on one particular thing. And while I was doing that, I found, because there was a record shop up in London, still there today, it's a collection of shops, actually, a chain in Notting Hill Gate. And they had, back when I was going in the 80s, there was 3 or 4 record and tape exchanges just there. And then you had another one in Camden Town. They ended up opening one on Berwick Street, which is off Oxford Street. Different things like that. But what they would do, and this was every record that comes in, for example, when albums were £6 each new, they'd put it out at £6. And then each week they'd knock the price down by £1. And they had a rare record department in one of their Notting Hill Gate shops upstairs. So what I used to do was I'd go there with my headphones on. I was obviously listening to my little Walkman back then, cassettes, music, maybe even Dire Straits, who knows. And I would go flicking through them, all the records that they had, and you find something that started off at 30 and it's down to a fiver, and you think, well, I'll buy that. I might not even know what it is. But what they tended to do, record dealers, is that they would give you half what they sold for. So if you got something for a fiver that they were selling for 30, then you should get £15 for it from another record dealer. Unfortunately, their prices could be a bit skew-whiff, so, you know, you could also lose money as gain money and stuff like that. And consequently, I got to do that. I'd take what I bought to record fairs, because that's when they rent out a great big hall. There was a TUC conference centre on Tottenham Court Road, which they had one a month, which was one of the biggest record fairs. It was called the VIP Record Fair back in the 80s. There was one at the Brighton Centre every couple of months or so. So that was a trip down to the coast on the train, which was fun. And in there you get, I remember there was 200 stalls. So that meant some dealers had more than one stall if they had a big collection. But you probably get about, I don't know, 70, 80 different dealers there. So you've got 70, 80 people to show you records to in the hope that some will buy them. Do you know what I mean? And I used to do reasonably well, to the extent that the car cleaning business that I'd set up when I was younger, I stopped doing for a while But then I had to go back to my customers with my tail between my legs that my new venture hadn't quite worked out. So I'm going to have to go back to cleaning their cars if they haven't got anyone else, which they didn't. So I carried on. But not a very good businessman, unfortunately, historically. But the guy that I ended up working for was. And what happened with him was he was someone who I would chat to. I don't think he ever bought any of my records, but he asked if I'd want to help him out at record fairs. And he would pick me up in the early hours of the morning. I remember one time we went to Oxford and I had to meet him on this roundabout near where I live so he could just pull into the bus stop and I could jump in. And I'd help him set up the stall and obviously taking the money and stuff like that. I remember one time someone tried to pass us a counterfeit £20 note and it was so ridiculous. It was like, you could feel it was thick paper. It was like, what's this? You know what I mean? So anyway, that was interesting. But one thing that he said to me was his dad had got him into record collecting. And his dad, his aim when he would go out to, say, car boot sales, what he wanted to do back in the 70s, 80s, what have you, was his dream was when he would find a record, like a single for 10p, that was worth £10. And what the dealer said to me is you're better off spending £50 on a record that's worth £100, you see. And of course, you see the logic there that obviously you're spending more, but you're getting more back. And that was his thoughts. And he went on to have he kind of stopped doing the record fairs. I ended up going to Paris and Milan with him, of all things. So we'd get boat over across the channel and then drive through down to Milan, obviously not so far for Paris. And it was great fun doing record fairs over there, because the way that he used to do it by doing these foreign fairs is all his records were priced by a coloured dot. And so a red dot might be £5. And when he would do Paris or Milan, what have you, this was pre-euro, so he put whatever that was in francs, so the red dot was its equivalent in francs, for example, which probably about 50 francs, and used to be 10 francs to the pound, and then in Italy it would have been in Italian lira, stuff like that, so he didn't have to reprice everything, you know. And I bumped into him probably 10, 15 years ago and stuff, and he'd moved more to straight on the internet now. And that's what he was doing. And I remember he was doing very well at it. So, yeah, there you go. That's some of my experiences with Rare Records. If I can point out some of the most famous items would be God Save the Queen by the Sex Pistols on A&M. That was the company that they signed for. They did all sorts of horrible film things during their party after the signing. So the record company dropped them straight away. Had to pay him a load of money, but during that time, they started pressing a 7-inch single of God Save the Queen. Again, these were supposed to have been destroyed, but a few leaked out. But they've been pirated several times, so I wouldn't trust it. The other one that comes to mind is The Beatles' Please Please Me. That came out on stereo, and it's you can find it. It's gold label stereo. And all their original albums were produced on mono, and of course this is the first one, so I'm not sure the ins and outs of what happened there, but you can still find some of them. I saw someone on eBay have one for about £15,000. So in the grand scheme of things, if I were one of these Elon Musk types, or even not quite as wealthy as that but had a big disposable income, I'd rather surround my, you know, have things on the wall like these Rare Records than some, you know, piece of modern art that might cost, you know, 100,000 or something like that. And oh, it's supposed to mean this, that and the other. These things are cheap for what they are. I was looking at gold, you know, records awarded when you get a gold record, you know, the sort of things you see hanging up in the Hard Rock Cafe, stuff like that. And there was a wonderful item, and it's actually a very good album, but it's the only album I've got by this individual. And if you were a collector of this person, it would be the ultimate, because it was a gold record presented to Tori Amos for her first album, Little Earthquakes, for 100,000 copies, I believe, in the UK. And the guy wanted about £1,200 for it. So that's the ultimate in these sort of things, and they're of course incredibly rare. So I remember I saw one a couple of years ago, and it was around that amount, 1,000, something like that, and it was for dire straits, but it was some sort of award, and it wasn't really one that I've heard of. You really want one by the, I think, RIAA, is that the company that awards them in America, or I think it's the BPI in the UK. But this was by an organisation I hadn't heard of, and I'm like, if it was something, and even then, if it was something, it's a lot of money to pay out. I'm not one of those Elon Musk types, so I don't have that. But there are some nice items out there. The other thing is that if your hobby's not records or anything like that, you might like books. And a rare book site, where I've bought a lot of first edition books and what have you, and they have sites all around the world. It's abebooks.com. That's the letter A, the letter B, the letter E. abebooks.com. They have a .co.uk site, which is the one I use. And you can type in people there. You can sort by. So if you get like a particular author. And we'll try it now, shall we? If you get a particular author. So we'll try and find someone famous. And I think that you can just type in their name. And you can sort it by price, like, you know, you can on eBay, you can sort by highest price, which again is something I like doing when I'm doing a bit bored and I'm doing this window shopping thing. And I'll tell you something, folks. Yesterday I was listening to one of the audio commentaries. I believe it was the audio commentary for Halloween 4. Which was, for me, it's, for nostalgic, everything seems to come together. That would be my favourite horror film. It's not the best horror film ever made, but because of the memories, the way it came about, and my reaction to it, that will always remain my favourite. And it was originally written by a guy it came out in 1988, and it was designed to be a successor to 1981's Halloween 2, because Halloween 3 was a different story. And it was mentioned that a guy had written original scripts, a guy called, I think, Dennis Aitchison or something like that. And he'd written the original script for it and it had been rejected. And so I looked it up yesterday, and you can actually find it on archive.org. Halloween 4, Dennis Aitchison, Etchison, original script. And I spent most of yesterday reading it to see what that film would have been like if they'd have used his script. And even on the Halloween 4 Wikipedia page, it mentions that the owner of the Halloween franchise, Mustafa Akkad, he called it too cerebral. I had to look that word up, and it means too intellectual. And he wanted just a plain old sort of a killer slasher, that type of film. So I read the whole thing through, and this was like, had like 12-foot Michael Myers appearing everywhere. It was like a ghostly thing. It was absolutely dreadful. And I'm pleased that they didn't put that together. But it took me probably a good hour or so to read. But I'm pleased that I did something a bit different to do in the evening. So anyway, I can get up to all sorts of go in all different directions. And that's what I try and do with this show, and hope that you find the directions in which I'm going of interest. Right, so I've typed in Stephen King to abebooks.com, and it says over 57,000 results. So sort by relevance. No, we want to sort by... Can we sort by... Oh, there it is, highest price. Let's sort by highest price. And the highest price one is Firestarter. Right. Let's read about this. It's £58,000, $58,000, folks. So that is a lot of money. And It says, condition near fine, signed limited first edition, one of a limited 26 lettered copies, signed and dated by Stephen King, bound in aluminium coated cloth, sometimes called the asbestos fire starter. Near fine with trivial soiling and trivial wear. A very bright copy of this legendary rarity, the holy grail for Stephen King collectors, and perhaps his scarcest collectible. It is also the first of King's signed limited edition books. So that's the sort of money things can go for. You can have fun, as I say, if you like books. And think about other things. If they're, you might have collections of pottery or all sorts of things you might like. And it's not going to be like trying to find me on the internet. I don't think they're censoring things like pottery yet. But you can have a look around, find a site like that. And you could have a lot of fun with that. And you might even find something you really wanted. And because eBay, you see, is not a catch-all site. A lot of people, you're not, as I say, you're not going to find what you do on specialist sites for books or for music, things like that, on eBay. You can find some very interesting stuff. There was a stage that the Beatles had played on that they wanted about £100,000 for. It had been sort of dismantled and boxed up. I mean, who's going to want to put that up somewhere? I mean, it seemed a bit strange to me. But, you know, the other thing about it, and I know this is a cliche, when you see them on these auction shows and they say, what's something worth? And the presenter always says, oh, well, it's worth whatever someone's prepared to pay for it. But that is very true. You know, I have sold stuff on eBay and I've generally lost money. I haven't done it for years and years and years because I don't have a PayPal account. So it's, you know, a lot of people see that and they're like, well, I'm not going to use, I only ever use PayPal. I'm not going to suddenly use a credit card just for you. I use PayPal. So, of course, that's another reason that they do it, to hit you any which way that they can. But I've also made money on certain things that I thought, why is this so popular? You know, so you never really know at the time. A lot of it's it's a fashion thing. You know, it's something in vogue at the moment. And if it isn't, people aren't necessarily going to buy it. The rarest Dire Straits thing, my holy grail for Dire Straits, was the first ever CD single made was by Dire Straits. It was Brothers in Arms. It's a special edition. It was a beautifully done, because the Brothers in Arms album cover has got a blue background and pink writing, and they reversed it. So this has got a pink background and blue writing. And when they were at their height in the mid-80s, this was going for like up to £400, which is a lot of money. But another record dealer off Tottenham Court Road, Hanway Street, I believe, you come out of Tottenham Court Road Tube, and he's down there on the left, and he was a guy that I used to visit a lot, and he asked me to work for him one Christmas, so I think all of December. It was only on a Saturday. He used to open up at 2 in the afternoon, not before. He was very much a night owl. He'd stay up until about 7 or 8, so I'd turn up, and I'd help him serving customers because there was more customers in December. Ow, just banged my table with my finger. Yeah, it was fun because I was only 15, 16 years old at the time, and you're working on a, you know, record shop. Hanway Street is a road that is off Tottenham Court Road and off Oxford Street. So it's sort of, it goes, kind of cuts behind both of them. So you can walk either way and pop out on either street. So pretty nice part of London to be working in. Quite cool, isn't it, to be working in a record shop at that age. And I'm not sure where I was going with that, but that's where I was going. So when I moved to Dorset in 2001, I would still visit London now and then, and I would always go and pop in and say hello. And so we stayed in touch over the years until one time I went down there and the shop was no longer there. It was some sort of vegetarian restaurant with like Buddhist overtones. But the last time I went there, I pointed out that there was water, like rain, leaking down the walls of his shop. And what happened is he'd rented this since the 70s, and we're going back to, you know, the early 2000s now. And they were trying to get him out, because it was one of these things where your rent is protected at a certain level. And of course, if they can get you out, they can charge whatever they want to next people. He ended up going. I don't know what happened to him, if, you know, they just made life so unbearable for him that he just had to pack up and go. But he's not there anymore. But he was a nice guy. And one time I went there, so, you know, in the early 2000s, and I saw he had a copy of this Dire Straits Brothers in Arms CD single, promo only, limited to about 250 copies, something like that, on the wall. I said, oh, I see you got that. And I'd owned one years ago and got rid of it, like I had most of my collection, went on to rebuy it, thinking that I would, you know, get the same pleasure out of it that I did when I was a child, and surprisingly, I didn't. But, oh, he said, if you want that, you can have it for 20 quid. And I mean, I think I got a good price for mine. I think I paid only 60 for mine in the late 80s, so it peaked at about 400, then interest was waning. Dire Straits hadn't done anything for a few years. But £20 in, you know, was a steal like 20 years ago. So I bought it and I've still got it. And anyway, so it is fun to do things like this. But let's move on to, where did I want to go? Ah, yes. I typed my name into abbooks.com. Is there any rare books of mine? Because I've got probably the best knowledge of my own rare books, because I've been involved in all of them, from the first one that I got printed myself to where it is today with Dave Gahari on moneytreepublishing.com. And if you scroll down on my website, on the right hand side, you will see the book covers, and you can click on them and they take you right over there. But I typed my name into abbooks.com and nothing came up at all, and I thought, I find that strange. I mean, it could be that no one's got anything on there, or it could be that they've blocked me on there. But so what I did after that, and I'll do that now as well, is I went over to eBay and I typed my name into there. And this is the .co.uk site. So I'm just going to type my name in now. Click that. And we've got a load of the Tex Mars copies coming up at the top. So 1, 2, 3. Then there's a updated, expanded version, brand new. These are all coming out in the United States, but they're listed on the .co.uk website. And then there's the German version, which was called Satan's Banker, because they didn't want to use the title that I had. So it's not blocked on eBay, but it may be blocked on AB Books, or it may be that there's no sellers offering it on there at the moment. But this led me onto a little quest to do a test of Amazon. Because, as you know, my book was taken down by Amazon, along with a lot of other people's books, such as MS King's The Bad War and other titles. So I went on there thinking it'd be great if I could come up with a... I even had the title, The Amazon History, something or other, I don't know what it was. What I was trying to do was, I was thinking that, is there a premise that if you go onto Amazon looking for a book that gives an alternative view of history to the mainstream, that the only ones listed are the ones that they sanction? So I'm going to start off with, you know, it was going very well at the start, because this is The True Story of the Bilderberg Group by Daniel Estulin. And this is on there. So I was thinking, maybe they're just... Because the point is... Well, let me read the description first. This is what it says. Delving into a world once shrouded in complete mystery and impenetrable security, this investigative report provides a fascinating account of the annual meetings of the world's most powerful people, the Bilderberg Group. Since its inception in 1954 at the Bilderberg Hotel in the small Dutch town of Oosterbeek. The Bilderberg Group has been comprised of European prime ministers, American presidents, and the wealthiest CEOs of the world, all coming together to discuss the economic and political future of humanity. The working press has never been allowed to attend, nor have statements ever been released on the attendees' conclusions or discussions, which have ramifications on the citizens of the world. So, talking about the world's most powerful people. So, a lot of people, okay, that think outside of the mainstream, this is a catch-all for them. It's like some of these people that are prominent in the mainstream that will talk about a lot of what goes on, but then they won't tell you the real people behind it. Some people will look at this, and 563 people have left reviews that are 4.6 out of 5, so they're sold on this, that this is where the rabbit hole ends, and it's all just this organisation. So I thought, oh, that is interesting. And then I thought I'd look up Kennedy assassination and see what books came up with the Kennedy assassination. And this one popped down about halfway through the results, so it wasn't pointed to at the top, but it's called An Umbrella of Lies, The Covert Filmer, The Altered Film, and The Assassination of JFK. The author is Michael John Collins. And I thought, wow, is this an attempt to make people think this is the Michael Collins Piper book on the Kennedy assassination? So I then typed in Michael Collins Piper, expecting no results, and up at the top of the Michael Collins Piper search term in books on Amazon is Final Judgment, The Missing Link in the JFK Assassination Conspiracy, Kindle edition, available instantly, £3.87. So it didn't prove to be what I thought it would be, but I still thought I would bring my findings to you. You see, if you type in this, I'll do it now anyway, because I've mentioned this before, but I'm here, so let's do it. Type in the Synagogue of Satan. Funnily enough, when I did that, you know, when it fills the rest of the line for you, it said the Synagogue of Satan, Andrew Hitchcock, so that indicates that other people have been looking for it with my name, just omitting the Carrington. But let's... So, here we are, I've got the results. So this is a search for Synagogue, the Synagogue of Satan in books on amazon.co.uk. The Synagogue of Satan by Milan Martin. The Synagogue of Satan by Stanislaw Przybyszewski. Le Plan de la Synagogue of Satan by William Guy Carr and Andre Segura. So I wasn't the first, obviously the first coining of the term the Synagogue of Satan was the book of Revelation 2:9 and 3:9. But in the modern era, it wasn't me, although I thought it was when I brought it out. Actually, William Guy Carr, in his book Pawns in the Game, which you can find online, I do believe I've got an audiobook of that. I might have actually played it on some of my episodes of the show. But he talked about that, and his book was, I think, 58. So he got to it long before I did. And then he was like a formal naval officer, I believe, out of America. And he did some other books as well. Red Fog over... am I starting to confuse it with Myron Fagan's audio? Pawns in the Game's definitely there. If you look him up, he might even have a Wikipedia page. But this book here, Les Plans de la Synagogue of Satan, seems to be an offshoot, French offshoot of Pawns in the Game. And then we've got Catharsis, Tomo 3, La Synagogue de Satan. Another French one. Synagogue of Satan, exposing the two most dangerous churches in Nigeria. Well, I doubt that people would buy that by mistakenly thinking it was my book. Then you've got Satan's Synagogue by Brian Josepher. La Psychologie Salon, La Synagogue de Satan, en dans l'Anglaise de Dieu by Pascal Trafenegai. Another one of his, well, it's the same book by the looks of it. Waging Winning War in the Spirit Realm, The Synagogue of Satan and Its Ruling Powers, Volume 2, Spiritual Warfare by James V. Potter and Paula M. Potter. Then La Synagogue de Satan by Francois Rosset. Le Franc McConnery, Synagogue de Satan Facsimile, 1893 by M.G.R., is that Monsignor? Leon Marin, maybe. The Heretical Protocols of the Synagogue of Satan by Michael Miller. Synagogue of Satan by Charles W. Schaeffer. Temple of Satan, the Devil's Disciples, so that's not easily confused. Then we've got Synagogue of Satan Bible Study, the New Age Movement by Pat Holliday. And that's just page one. So you can see my suspicion. Well, I see all these books coming out with that title in. Because I remember years ago, it would only turn up, if you typed in the Synagogue of Satan to Amazon, my book would come up, and there was only one other. And it was by some sort of Muslim guy that is not part of these results. So I'm going to click on page two. I'm not going to bore you with all the titles again, but I'm going to see if he comes up, because I'd recognise it. But no, so he's gone too. So I don't know if that's due to censorship or anything else. But that was my kind of thoughts on that with Amazon, where I was going and thinking I was going. But when I found the Michael Collins Piper on a very easy search just for his name, and one of his most controversial books came out the top, you know, they're not, it's a bit scattergun. For me, it's not a complete, there are some things on there you'd be surprised to find on there, bearing in mind what they've banned. Does that make sense? But another couple of things. So, for example, Alex Jones, okay? Now, there's all this stuff in the mainstream media. He denied that these people died at Sandy Hook, and what a monster he is, and how he's upset all these parents, and blah, 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 blah. You'd think that they wouldn't have anything Alex Jones on there because of that kind of mainstream media flavour that's been put out there. But his book, The Great Reset and the War for the World, that is on there. And you can buy that in Kindle or hardcover. And that's got 4.8 out of 5, based upon 4,819 reviews. And it says, this great opening paragraph, in The Great Reset and The War for the World, the most controversial man on earth, Alex Jones, gives you a full analysis of The Great Reset, the global elite's international conspiracy to enslave humanity and all life on the planet. So again, this is a catch-all where he'll tell you a lot of what's going on, but he won't come to the same conclusions as someone like myself. But my conclusions are not allowed on Amazon, though his are, as are the person who talked about the Bilderberg Group. A couple of books that I was interested to see, and I was actually looking for this. I wanted to read the descriptions to you, because this very much differs from what you will read in the mainstream media. In fact, this first one, it brings to mind the showdown between Ken Livingstone. Well, it wasn't Ken Livingstone, he was just walking along minding his own business, and this MP called Surname Man, he's been given a peerage now, so he's Lord Man, was confronting him about how evil he was to insinuate that there was any collaboration between the Nazis and the Jews during the Second World War, around the Second World War era, okay? I'm going to read you the description, because I've always said, this book is even on Amazon that talks about it. It's by a guy called Edwin Black, who, according to the front cover I'm looking at here on Amazon, the New York Times best-selling author of IBM and the Holocaust and the War Against the Weak. And it's got an afterword by Abraham H. Foxman, who was the head of the ADL before Jonathan Greenblatt. At the top it says, the transfer agreement, the dramatic Zionist rescue of Jews from the Third Reich to Jewish Palestine. 25th anniversary edition. Let me see, can I scroll down for a longer... No, let's go with this one at the top. The Transfer Agreement is Edwin Black's compelling award-winning story of a negotiated rescue in 1933 between Zionist organisations and the Nazis to transfer some 50,000 Jews and $100 million of their assets to Jewish Palestine. In the process, the organised worldwide Jewish-led boycott against Hitler was stopped. 25th anniversary edition. And in the other book, you might remember there's a book called Hitler's Jewish Soldiers by Brian Mark Rigg. Well, he's done a follow-up to it. This one's called Lives of Hitler's Jewish Soldiers, Untold Tales of Men of Jewish Descent Who Fought for the Third Reich. And this is the description from Amazon. They were foot soldiers and officers. They served in the regular army and the Waffen-SS. And remarkably, they were also Jewish, at least as defined by Hitler's infamous race laws. Pursuing the thread he first unravelled in Hitler's Jewish Soldiers, Brian Rigg takes a closer look at the experiences of Wehrmacht soldiers who were classified as Jewish. In this long-awaited companion volume, he presents interviews with 21 of these men whose stories are both fascinating and disturbing. As many as 150,000 Jews and partial Jews, or Mischling, served often with distinction in the German military during World War II. So that was some material I came up with you for you today, even to really give you some additional things in the show, because as you know, I'd only done a show on Saturday, so there's not a great deal of news to cover. But we're going to go over to see what there is now. That this is what I found interesting since Saturday's show. Okay, so turns out you've probably heard about all these immigrants being put up in hotels, these people coming over on these dinghies into the UK, being put up in these five-star hotels. Well, the government now wants to get landlords to rent out private homes to these people. And as someone who's looking to rent out his mother's house, I wouldn't actually do this, but it's very attractive. You can see why some people would, because I'll tell you what the deal is. The deal is that Serco, which runs the prisons and private prisons, stuff like that, prisoner transport, so they're some big company that I believe has some involvement with one of the descendants of Winston Churchill, I believe his grandson or something like that. They're apparently looking for landlords, investors and agents with properties in the northwest, the Midlands and the east of England to lease for more than 5 years. But get this for the deal. It includes promises of rent to be paid on time every month with no arrears, free property management, full repair and maintenance, as well as utilities and council tax bills paid by Serco. Well, whoever rents the house pays those bills anyway, but presumably they can't trust them to do well. Let's be honest, there are benefits in there, so they wouldn't be doing that. But so I don't know why they threw that bit in. But as a landlord, one of the biggest worries you've got is somebody moves in, they don't pay the rent. And then it can take you years to get them out. So there's that. Another worry that you have is that they're going to go there and trash the place. Well, even if things go wrong here, that you as a landlord would have to pay to have repaired, they're going to manage the property for free and repair and maintain it for free. And you've got guaranteed rent for 5 years. You know, you might end up getting the house back and it's all been done up to a certain extent, because they're going to have to do something at the end of it. And they might just have a standard system where we go back around and repaint everything, clean everything up and what have you. So I can see how this could be attractive to landlords. But it's not something that I, in good conscience, could do, because I don't agree with people coming in illegally to this country and getting the sort of benefits that they do. So anyway, then we move on to these protests. And I'm going to show you a disparity in protests here. It was the London Marathon yesterday, and a couple of protesters, they jumped into the path of it. These are these youth demand people who were raided. I think it's the same people that were raided at that Quaker house in London. And the interesting thing is that they were dragged away, they were arrested, and last I heard that they were still in custody. But I'm looking at an article from yesterday. But get this, they were wearing Stop Arming Israel t-shirts. Gaza, it said on the t-shirt, Gaza is running out of food, arming genocide crosses the line. So these people pulled away quickly, arrested, taken in custody. Then we move on to another story I found yesterday as well, on the same website, Daily Mail. And, oh, where is it? I clicked on the same one. Here it is. Right, so this was right near the bottom of the news front page. Moment van appears to drive through Just Stop Oil protesters while eco-zealots marched through London as frustration boils over in the capital. So, here, you sort of scroll down the article, and it says these people are blocking a road, and one of them shouted to the police officer, "I'm being pushed back." So the driver got out of the vehicle and shouted, "What are you doing blocking the whole road up?" and saying to police, "What about my right to get home?" And then, apparently there's a film that captures the officers reminding the man that the disruption is temporary and the people had the right to protest. So this is Just Stop Oil. So what are they saying? They're saying that they've got a right to protest Just Stop Oil. Or have they got a right to protest? Because if they've got a right to protest, why did they quickly grab these ones protesting what was going on in Gaza out the way of the London Marathon? You see, again, they talk about two-tier stuff. The principle's the same. They're both people protesting. Why is one arrested and taken off in custody and the other, they're told, well, they've got a perfect right to protest? Doesn't make sense. And that's so much in this country doesn't today and around the world. Okay. Well, we go back to the protest against the what was going on in Gaza, and we find out that an Israeli airstrike has killed 10 people after flattening a three-story home in Gaza, with at least 5 children among the dead. That was over the weekend, and apparently strikes across the region have killed at least 49 people. So there you go. It sounds like these people at the London Marathon did have a legitimate thing that they were protesting. They weren't making it up. But at the same point, I don't agree with blocking anything, roads, what have you, sporting events, as part of a protest. Because if I was the driver in that car trying to get home, you're not going to endear me to your cause. I remember I was driving down Banstead High Street during COVID. And I couldn't believe it, because Banstead's like a small place. And it was, they had all these people stood in the row with banners up by the road warning people about the vaccines. And I ended up waving to them as I went past. But they were there. They were stood by the road. They were holding up signs. Some people were waving, tooting their agreement, stuff like that. But if you didn't agree with them, you weren't going to get annoyed unless you were one of these, you know, lunatics that can't have any of their beliefs challenged, because they weren't causing you any problem. They were stood by the side of the road, not on the road, by the curb, with a sign up. You can read it, you can't read it, whatever you want to do. And they weren't causing any disruption to people. So that to me is okay. But protests when you are stopping people from getting to A to B, it's just not on. And that shouldn't be allowed. So, again, I just feel the whole thing is very, very suspicious. Just Stop Oil? What are they trying to do? They're trying to get us all into electric cars, aren't they? Sounds like these could be some foot soldiers on the street. And that's why they're told not to touch these people. But when it comes to other issues that they don't want you talking about, oh, we shut these people up straight away. That's what it looks like to me. I may be right or I may be wrong. But as I always say on this show, you be the judge. And finally, a study, if you can call it that, between a university in the UK called Kiel and one in Amsterdam is saying that people swearing is good for you. Well, I'll just read the Daily Mail headline for you. It's official. Swearing is good for you. Repeating expletives not only makes us happier and more positive, but also boosts our strength, researchers discover. So again, the endorsement. And now they're only reporting what this study has said. But who was behind the study? Who? What what's the result they want? Do you remember these things that came out during COVID where doctors were revealing, well, what happens is that if you go to someone that would sponsor these sort of papers, you have to basically tell them what you're looking to prove with your outcome to get the funding. So if you wanted to go and prove that the a particular COVID vaccine was causing harm to people, I don't think you're going to get any funding for it. But if you're going to go with something else and it's causing no problems at all, I think the funding will be pouring in. So if you want to continue to destroy the morality in society and you want someone to prove that swearing is good for you, to encourage more people to swear and do immoral things, then you're going to support that, aren't you? And then you're going to use, you're going to publicise it one way or another once you've got the answers, the findings rather, that you wanted. That's my opinion on that. Okay, so let's go over now to see what's going on. One thing I forgot to mention. I said I'm not going to mention other people's shows on here anymore. But I am going to mention a couple of things here because they're relevant to things that we've talked about. Now, Robert Ravel, he's got a very popular show on republicbroadcasting.org, or where I go for it is republicbroadcastingarchives.org. And he did his final Sunday show yesterday. He has reiterated that he wants to come back at some point in the future, but at a different time slot. Okay, so republicbroadcastingarchives.org, go over there and you can download the last show. Now, if you're not listening to this on the Monday, because my Monday mornings are never going to be the same, because I used to first thing go and download this show, and that would be what I'd start off my Monday listening to. It will have dropped off the front page because as new shows are broadcast, they push the old ones down, etc. So you would then click on the drop-down list on the right-hand side of hosts and you will click his name and that show will come up. I'd be very surprised if he does come back and fill in the immediate future on that slot, because he called it his Bon Voyage, his farewell show. He played The Doors, The End as his last sort of bumper music and things like that. I'm imagining that they've got a new format or a new host in place. Now, what's I'm going to find interesting about it is if you're offered a gig like that, where you've already got these people that tune in religiously, probably the wrong word, but you know what I'm getting at, they're regulars at that time every Sunday, a lot of them calling because Robert takes callers, it would take a very brave replacement show to abandon all of that that's already there, because it's almost as if you do something similar to what Robert did, then you've got a ready-made audience already there for you. So that's what I'm expecting to come in, a similar news roundup show presented by someone else so they can utilise the following they've already got in that particular time slot on a Sunday night. I am going to make a prediction. I don't know any inside information, folks, I promise you. But he had a few guest hosts, two, three guest hosts that I recall, in the times he wasn't doing the show in the last few months. One of them is Frederick C. Blackburn, Blackbird 9. Now, he already has a one-hour show on RBN on Saturdays called the Saturday Snack Shack. I think that he's probably going to be the guy that ends up taking that slot, because obviously he's filled in before, so he can do that time, and we will see. I only mention it because I may be right, I may be wrong, and I will report back to see if I am right or wrong. But I'll also be going there next week. Whoever it is, I'm going to be downloading it and listening to see how the show is. Because I'm, being as I do show myself, I'm very interested. I'm like what when Jose Mourinho, after Arsene Wenger, the Arsenal manager, was commenting on Mourinho's Chelsea team, he accused him of being a voyeur. Well, I admit, I'm interested to see how other people's shows go, put together, stuff like that, because that's what I do. So I'm kind of interested. And the other show I want to mention, excuse me for a moment. Oh dear, getting blocked up here. Oh, I nearly knocked the water over as well. A little drink there. BitChute. Now, as we know, BitChute.com is no longer available in the UK. But Mark Collett, he did an interview with the owner of BitChute. Now, of course, if you're outside the UK, you will probably get it on Mark Collett's BitChute channel, which we can't get over here in the UK. So where you have to go to get it, where I got it this morning, is odyssey.com. Now, I'm going to spell that for you because, again, if you don't put the right spelling in, I very much doubt the search engines are going to help you out here because they don't want you going here. But it's O-D-Y-S-E-E. O-D-Y-S-E-E.com. And then if you just type Mark Collett into the search box, his channel should come up. And it's called BitChute versus Ofcom, which is the regulator here in the UK, regulates communications, television, websites, etc. BitChute versus Ofcom, interview with the owner of BitChute. So it comes in at just over an hour. So I'll be listening to that later. I just wanted to share those with you because especially if you're in the UK, it'd be quite interesting to hear what the owner of BitChute has to tell you about what really went on there. Okay, so let's see what's going on right now in the mainstream media. So I'm going over to, well, we always start with Associated Press, don't we? I was thinking I'd be reporting back on the Canada election for you because that was, wasn't that on a Sunday? Well, it turns out it's on a Monday, so it's happening today. But we did have a what the AP is calling the darkest day in Vancouver when a car slammed into a crowded festival. I believe 11 people were killed. The suspect's been charged with murder and hundreds are attending vigils for the victims. And it was a Filipino street festival. And the name of the guy did have a Filipino Chinesey sort of sound to it. Let me just click on it so I can read it out for you if it comes out sort of early on in this article. It was the Lapu Lapu Day Festival on Saturday night. 11 people died and dozens were injured. And it it's one of these things that oh, here we are. The British Columbia Prosecution Service charged K.G. Adam Lowe with 8 counts of second-degree murder on Sunday and said more charges were possible. They've ruled out terrorism. The Vancouver mayor, Ken Sim, said the suspect has a significant history of mental health issues. Okay, let's go over to BBC News and see what their top 10 most stories are, most read. So just waiting for that to load up as we scroll down. Number 10, they vowed to stop bombing after Myanmar's earthquake. I saw the airstrikes continue. Number 9, woman hurt in attack involving crossbow stable. Number 8, grandpa robbers held Kim Kardashian at gunpoint but didn't know who she was. Number 7, daughter of murdered MP calls for kneecap apology. So that is the Irish man kneecap that we've been talking about on here. The daughter of Conservative MP was stabbed to death at the, yeah, this is, yeah, well, I'll just read you the opening. This is Katie Amess, whose father, David Amess, was murdered in 2021 at his office by someone or other. The daughter of a Conservative MP was stabbed to death at a constituency surgery has said rap group Kneecap should apologise over comments where they allegedly called for MPs to be killed. A video emerged of the West Belfast trio at a November 2023 gig, appearing to show one person from the band saying, "The only good Tory is a dead Tory, kill your local MP." The Tory party leader, Kemi Badenoch, has called for a police prosecution. And the footage, as I mentioned on a previous show, is being assessed by counter-terrorism police. Okay, so that was our number 8, was it? No, number 7. So number 6, the rapid remaking of a nation in 100 days. I have no idea what they're talking about there. Number 5, ministers face above projected teacher and NHS pay deals. Number 4, Girl 5 Among Vancouver Dead as Suspect Charged. Number 3, Top Brand Baby Food Pouches Lack Key Nutrients. Number 2, Branded School Uniforms to Charge for 4 Million Pupils Under Plans. And number 1, Boy Admits Stabbing 15-Year-Old But Denies Murder. Let's have a look at the Daily Mail now, see what's going on over there. The top headline is the secret role Prince William played before extraordinary Pope funeral talks between Trump and Zelensky to end Ukraine war. Now, this is some story I have actually been following over the weekend, because what the mainstream media are saying is that these were really positive talks between Trump and Zelensky, and Trump's going to turn against Putin and all this sort of stuff. But I was on Hal Turner Radio Show website, and he said that they were supposed to have another meeting later in the day, but Trump snubbed him and took Air Force One back to Washington. And that's why later in the day you saw him meeting with Macron, was it? In a different place, not in that basilica or whatever it is, that cathedral-like setting where they're sat on chairs opposite each other, but they were sat in a garden somewhere. That was apparently supposed to be Trump, if I was reading what Hal Turner said correctly. But the mainstream media are all about, oh, they're really patching it up. He's really going to turn against Putin and stuff like that. So I'd be interested to see if there's anything going on behind the scenes there. We've got local elections coming up this week. They're generally on a Thursday. Headline, Tories face losing 500 seats in reform local election surge as Keir Starmer stays away from Runcorn by-election after Labour suffers worst poll plunge ever for a new government. Something that why can I think of his name? I'm looking at him. Nigel Farage. Something he said in a recent article, and I believe he was writing for the Daily Mail. He said he will become the deporter-in-chief like Barack Obama. Not like Donald Trump. That was what he said. And of course, we've talked about this before, how many people in the independent media have said that Barack Obama actually deported more people than Donald Trump did. So that might be something that you might want to look into if you're not too busy looking up rare records and rare books. Okay, so let's move on to what's going on in the independent news. So I'll go for the latest with that. RT.com. Let's just... whatever. Kiev has escalated attacks on civilians. That's according to Moscow. It's a Russian website. Make of that what you will. Putin sends Freedom Day wishes to South Africa. And there's a picture of him smiling with Cyril Ramaphosa. Let's move on to rents.com. Right, scroll down. He's got a video. This is a new video. COVID jabbed people are collapsing and dying in public all over China. Cemeteries nearly full. So that is his... he has a different video that I never got a chance to look at. This takes you to a YouTube video, which takes me to a 15-minute ad. So I'm going to close that now before it plays. 15-second ad. But it takes longer than that to load it up and block it on Brave. So anyway, back to rents.com. So there's a video there. You might want to look at that. The top stories, senior Pakistani official threatens India with nukes. War between nuclear powers, India and Pakistan, could erupt at any moment. India's Prime Minister Modi vows harshest response to Pakistan over attack on Kashmir as tensions rise. Pakistani troops kill 54 Afghan militants trying to cross the border. Netanyahu says Iran's entire nuclear program must go. The US military hits over 800 targets in Yemen since March. Hundreds of Houthi rebels were killed. And Iran's Khamenei orders probe into port blasts that killed 40. I was listening to Robert Ravel actually talking about this, and he said if you sort of want to work out who did it, the principle of Occam's razor might come in useful there, but I'll just leave that one with you. Okay, let's move on to HalTurnerRadioShow.com. And The top headline: numerous countries issue travel warnings regarding Pakistan, while Army of India said fed up and prepared to destroy Pakistan. And then it's all pretty much that. And then the apparently after the explosion at the port of Bandar in Iran, port of Bandar Abbas, even in Iran, they're now seeing fires and explosions at multiple other sites. I believe that that was from... No, not yesterday. That was from Saturday. So, yeah. Okay, let's move on to earthnewspaper.com, my good friend Mark R. Elsis' news aggregate website. Just to let you know, As I said earlier, I tried to think of some topics to talk about early on. I hope they were of interest. I appreciate people supporting the show, and I can't just come on and do a 20-minute and say, look, you know, it's not my fault, that's all the news I've got. In the same way that if people, as I said earlier, another £15 and another show will be produced. I've been doing these shows for over 9 years, I've done over 2,500, and I feel I can come up with material that will be of interest to you that isn't necessarily news-based, although I will always delve into what news I've got in the parts of the show that I always do. Okay, so that being said, this is news. It's independent news. It's earthnewspaper.com. And at the top, there is a David Knight video, 22 minutes. Punishing those found not guilty is okay with US courts. That takes you to Rumble. The music of the day, we're going back to Saturday. On April 26, 1980, Blondie were at number one on the singles charts with on the UK singles charts with Call Me. I had that single, actually. The group's fourth UK number one, featured in the Richard Gere movie American Gigolo. The track was also a number one in the United States, where it became the band's biggest selling single. Producer Giorgio Moroder originally asked Stevie Nicks from Fleetwood Mac to help compose and perform a song for the soundtrack, but she declined. And let's scroll down to... There's a meme here. Oh, and there's my Saturday show. Quincy is like CSI on Valium, a great commentary and news show with my friend from across the pond, Andrew Carrington Hitchcock. Thank you very much, Mark, for putting that up. And again, this is one of these sites that is worth looking at to get all sorts of different information that I've mentioned, but you find a lot of shows here. I know a lot of you are rooting around and looking for shows. At the moment, the only uncensored shows are coming out of America, and I'm not endorsing these one way or another because some of them might be saying things I can't say here in the UK. But I will let you know that Dustin Nemos is on Brighton.com. We have the Eyes is Watching channel on Odyssey.com. We have FTJMedia.com. We have the Health Ranger Report, which is Brighton.com. I'm just going through all the American ones that I've got listed. Reese Report, Rumble.com. Richie from Boston, Rumble.com. But apparently he's got all his YouTube channels back. So he's been producing loads of content recently. Stu Peters, again, Rumble.com. The People's Voice, Rumble.com. True News, Brighton.com. Victor Hugo Art, Rumble.com. So hopefully that will give you an idea of other things to listen to out there from a country that appears to be the only one still not censored. But as I said on Saturday's show, they seem to be inching towards a online safety bill type setup over in the United States. So listen while you can. And let's finish off with the Before It's News Top 10. Incidentally, I was watching an episode of The Sweeney while I was having my breakfast before recording this show, and it had George Cole and John Hurt in it. And of course, John Hurt would go on to be a big film actor, launching his big film career with The Elephant Man, or was it The Naked Civil Servant? I think that was just a television programme where he played Quentin Crisp, but he had all sorts of big roles, like Alien, with that horrible thing coming out of his chest. And George Cole, interestingly, the series that George Dennis Waterman, who was one of the two lead actors of The Sweeney, along with John Thor. The series he went on to do, which ended up being even more successful than The Sweeney, was Minder, which his other lead actor was George Cole. So far, George Cole has been acting with John Thor in the episode, but I haven't seen him acting with Dennis Waterman yet. I hope that he does, because it'd be interesting to see the two of them together. Okay, so let's go over to beforeitsnews.com. Scroll down for the top 10. Number 10 went up 13 hours ago, 143 people viewing. Juan O'Savin and Michael Jaco emergency broadcast. Deep state arrests. Very scary times, really. 2025. Number 9 went up 6 hours ago, 166 people viewing. Estienon and Scott McKay, urgent intel, martial law imminent, US civil war is starting. Number 8 went up 10 hours ago, 187 people viewing. Cliff high, full intel drop, all hell is breaking loose in 48 hours. Number 7 went up 6 hours ago, 221 people viewing. Judy Byington, unredacted, EBS activation imminent. US braces for military takeover, Gasara stroke Nazara. Number 6 went up 10 hours ago, 236 people viewing. New X-22 report, April the 27th. Trump's mass arrests begin. It's going to be biblical. Number 5 went up 16 hours ago, 296 people viewing. I got that wrong, didn't I? Dave XRP Lion, Operation Red Sea moment. I saw behind the QFS Veil Redemption Centres. QFS, isn't that a furniture shop? Number 4 went up 14 hours ago, 330 people viewing. Mike Gill, time to end this game. Put up or shut up. Number 3 went up 13 hours ago, 349 people viewing. Updates with Juan O'Savin, Deep State at the Vatican, Pope Schwab and the Battle for the Church 2025. Number 2 went up 14 hours ago, 362 people viewing. Ismail Perez, Nightly Intel Update. And number 1 went up 14 hours ago, 496 people viewing. Nino, 33rd degree Mason, shares darkest secrets of Freemasonry and the one big royal secret. And there's a guy there who I presume is the Freemasonry guy with some huge ZZ Top style beard wearing a titfa. Okay, so I want to thank all of you for joining me on this bonus show today of I'm Talking to You, the rarest record in the world. I'll be back with you all with Peter tomorrow. I might be back with another bonus show earlier in the week, or I might be back on Saturday. But whatever the case, folks, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day, and bye for now.